Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Christopher Knapp, professor of philosophy at Binghamton University, and we're discussing Donald Worster's book, River Running West, The Life of John Wesley Powell. Christopher, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, this book is about John Wesley Powell. What makes his life interesting? What makes it merit such a substantial biography?
Well, Wesley Powell was a man who, starting from relatively humble beginnings, led a pretty extraordinary life. It's full of adventure and learning and even a fair amount of political power. He was a self-taught naturalist, a soldier in the Civil War, an explorer, a surveyor, a cultural anthropologist. And later on in his life, he became a spokesperson for the land and the people in the western part of our country, and a big proponent of large government scientific institutions. I think probably he's best known for his expedition down the Colorado River. At the time, no one knew quite where the Colorado River went. The Grand Canyon wasn't even on the map. And his exploration of that river basin was seen as a great public service. He effectively removed the last bit of unknown territory from the U.S. maps. And so he became famous during his day, not just as an adventurer, but as someone who had taken great risks and made great sacrifices for the public good. He didn't, though, rest on those laurels. Once the expedition was finished, he went on to become a surveyor of the West, and eventually to lead the U.S. Geological Survey, which was this massive undertaking dedicated to mapping out the terrain in the West and to sort of cataloging the natural resources that were available. And to just top it all off, he also started the Bureau of Ethnology in the Smithsonian. That was the wing of the Smithsonian that was dedicated to studying and chronicling Native cultures as they were fast disappearing. So really, really an extraordinary person and full of varied accomplishments.
Okay, you said that he's perhaps best known for the exploration of the Colorado, at least at the time he certainly was. Could you say a little bit more about what made this exploration so interesting, valuable?
Sure. Well, as I said, it was seen as this great public service. I think it's easy for us now, especially with the recent popularity of adventure stories, to think of exploration as primarily being the first person to do something or the, leading the first expedition. But here, the idea was not just to be the first person down the Colorado, but also to gather as much information about that part of the country as possible so that the that part of the country could be put to use. So it was seen as this great public service. At the same time, it did have its fair share of adventure and of sort of romantic appeal. It's a little hard for me to imagine, anyway, what exactly exploration in the 1870s must have been like. Spending day after day, month after month, out in the middle of literally nowhere, where you have no idea where you are, no communications, no villages, every few days to resupply. And on top of this, the terrain that this expedition went through was extremely challenging. It was inhospitable, to say the least, mostly desert, with just canyon rock walls for most of the way down the river. And Powell's crew was sort of a hodgepodge assemblage of you know, friends and relatives or relatives of patrons or supporters back in Washington and an odd frontiersman or two. So this wasn't a real professional outfit that he was leading down. And to top it all off, Powell only had one arm, having lost his other in a battle in the Civil War. So all of this contributed, I think, to making a very romantic story out of what was also seen to be something that was really done for the benefit of the country.
When you describe it in that way, I mean, it sounds as if Powell was a great lover of nature. I mean, would Powell be considered an environmentalist in modern-day terms?
Well, it's a not a simple question to answer, I think. And of course, in order to spend that amount of time in the natural world, especially in the inhospitable natural world, Powell did need to have a deep appreciation of nature. And in fact, you know, he was very taken with the emotional power of the Grand Canyon. You can imagine what it must have been like to have that vista open up for you, not expecting it entirely. And he called it the most sublime place on earth. But even his aesthetic appreciation, I think, of the Grand Canyon does contain hints of an approach to the environment that is a little bit different than we might have expected, especially as someone who's seen to be a big figure in the early environmental movement in the U.S. Aesthetically speaking, you can contrast the way Powell represented the environment with the way many of the painters of his day did. For instance, the painters whom he hired to sort of popularize the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River painted it in these very ethereal, powerful ways. The idea was to try to make the audience feel the presence of God in the paintings. Powell, on the other hand, when he went on popular speaking tours, made a point of always talking about the people in the environment. In this case, it was Indian people that he encountered. But his idea was that the land was a place that was essentially made to be inhabited, rather than a place for godly inspiration. That kind of attitude came out much more clearly later on when he became a political figure. He was an avid irrigationist, and he thought he aspired to helping the government drain the Colorado River by putting a series of dams down it so that the water could be spread out over the western land to irrigate farms. He proposed draining the Colorado and the Missouri River, the Okeechobee Lake in Florida, and he wanted to plant sugarcane on the bottom of the lake. So these are not what you might expect from a major environmental figure.
Does that mean that he really didn't love or care for or respect the environment at all? Or is it just somehow a different understanding of the environment in our relationship to it?
Well, I think it's a combination of several factors. I mean, I think he certainly loved the environment and the natural world in his way. But like I said, it was a way that was primarily focused on its usefulness for humans. And this is a contrast, or the contrast between that style of environmentalism and others is one that continues today. It's Powell's approach, I think, embodies what we now call a conservationist approach to the natural world. And conservationists argue that we must protect the natural world, you know, plants and animals and species and ecosystems, so that they will continue to provide resources for future generations of humans. So they see environmental protection as fundamentally a matter of self-interest, enlightened self-interest, but self-interest nonetheless. And the idea for them is that if the current generation of people greedily exploits the land, then we might soon find ourselves without the very resources we take for granted. And even if the resources don't disappear in our generation, if we greedily exploit the land now, we'll unfairly deprive our children or our children's children of those resources. So Powell was very concerned that this not happen. But that's approach to the land and protecting the land is very different from what is now called a preservationist approach. Preservationists argue that the natural world ought not be seen primarily as a human resource, but as something that's valuable in its own right, independent of what it can do for us. They typically defend environmental protection on the grounds that the natural world deserves to be left alone and deserves not to be degraded, and that harming plants or animals or ecosystems wrongs the plants or animals or ecosystems themselves, not just future generations of humans. So these two approaches, I think, are both concerned with the land and both evince a certain love and respect for the land, but at bottom have very different kinds of motivations. And so Powell, I think, fits pretty squarely in the conservationist camp.
Well, certainly in the second half of the show, I want to explore that difference a bit more. I am curious about one thing, though. I mean, even though conservationism, as you described it, is going to be certainly different from modern-day environmentalism or environmental protectionism, was it nonetheless sort of out of step with the ordinary way of thinking? I mean, was he at least ahead of his time in thinking that we needed to conserve the land?
Well, I think that's certainly the case, that he was forward-thinking. You know, the attitude of many people in the United States and the government and popularly, I think, at the time, was that the U.S. had just come out of the Civil War. The industrial machine was up and running. And here we had this huge gift in the West, a place that was full of resources that were just making, just waiting to make the U.S. Wealthy beyond compare. And so people were very optimistic about what the West could do for the country. And Powell really stuck his neck out at the time politically by trying to argue that we should put the brakes on, that in fact the West couldn't sustain massive development, that in fact it would be a huge mistake to send out hordes of people to settle the land, because the land just couldn't sustain that many farms. The farmers might be successful for a decade, but after that the land would be depleted, a drought or two would devastate them. So he certainly was ahead of his time, and courageously ahead of his time, since these weren't the kind of sentiments that people wanted to hear at the beginning of this, what they perceived to be a huge economic boom.
I suppose, too, I mean, you said at the beginning that when he took the trip down to Colorado, that one of the, well, that the overarching motivation of Powell and of the people who funded him was that they would get information about the land that could be put to human use. And I suppose one might wonder, could he have gotten support for such an exploration had it not been seen as a resource for human use?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I think the suspicion's right on the money. I think certainly if he had said, look, I'm just interested in making it down the river so that we can then cordon this area off and never touch it again, that he certainly would not have had a lot of support from the government, at the very least. So I think it's fair to say that perhaps his approach was, or his sort of view of the world, the natural world as a resource, was a necessary component of his explorations. But I will say that I think deep down Powell bought into this idea that the making a prosperous country was a moral ideal that everyone ought to aim at. So he had this this I think moral drive to improve the lot of Americans and to make the American democracy as absolutely economically successful as was possible.
Okay, I want to explore again this contrast between conservationism and protectionism in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Christopher Knapp, professor of philosophy at Binghamton University, and we're discussing Donald Worster's award-winning book, River Running West, The Life of John Wesley Powell. It might seem that Powell then was simply reflecting, perhaps a bit ahead of his time, but in some ways reflecting his time in terms of his attitude toward the land. Were there contemporaries of Powell, though, who had a somewhat different view about the land, a view much more akin to what you might call the modern-day environmentalist?
Well, certainly it's almost striking, I think, that the father of preservationism in America, John Muir, was almost exactly the same age as Wesley Powell. I think they were within a year of each other. And he, too, was the son of immigrant parents. I think that his parents were Scotch and Powell's were Welsh. Here, Muir was certainly contemporary, and in fact, a very similarly placed contemporary of Powell's. And he, I think, is considered by most people to be the founder of preservationism in the U.S. He's perhaps best known for starting the Sierra Club and for helping to convince the government, and particularly Teddy Roosevelt, to create national parks and wildlife preserves. He fought very big battles against Powell-style conservationists, concerning, in fact, just the kind of proposal that Powell championed. Perhaps his most famous battle was against the U.S. Forest Service plan to dam a river in the Yosemite National Park. The idea was that if they dammed the river, then they could flood a valley and make a reservoir, and the water from the reservoir could be used to provide water to growing San Francisco. And Muir vehemently opposed the plan for at least a decade. And because he thought that the valley that they proposed to flood was valuable in its natural state, and that value was more important than the value that came from any kind of resources that it might be able to supply to San Franciscan urbanites.
What was the result of that battle?
He lost. Eventually, it was a battle that took place both within within the press and I think personally for Teddy Roosevelt, who even after he agreed to the plan was would come out later on and say that he was regretful of it.
Now, did Powell play an active role in this debate?
No, interestingly not. This was a debate that happened, I guess, under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Forest Service, and it was Guilford Pinchot who was the prime representative there. Since Powell was in the U.S. Geological Survey, I think that the plan didn't fall under his jurisdiction since it was within the confines of a national park. Powell's proposals tended to concern land policy more than park management. He was interested in how the government ought to handle the distribution of western land and whether or not there ought to be limits on the amount of parcels that people could own, how big the parcels should be, whether or not the size of the parcels should depend on the quality of the resources within it, and so on.
And I take it then all those proposals were approved or disapproved according to his judgment about what would be the best over the long term for human beings?
Well, certainly that was his idea. He was very concerned about the welfare of American farmers in particular. And he thought that the greatest threat to the farmers and to the land that they depended on came from big business and big business development. He was very concerned that the dynamics of industrial improvement or even sort of industrial scale farming improvement would not would be unsustainable because that he recognized that the that these big businesses were primarily concerned with short-term profits, and that sustainability and short-term profits often work against one another. So he proposed, although they ultimately weren't accepted, all kinds of plans for trying to make sure that the people who were farming the land were individual farmers who were gathered together in communities centered around watersheds. And the idea being that since the community was small and depended on the land, that they would take care of it for more than just their immediate profit, but also for the benefit of their children and their children's children.
Would it be fair to say then that in that sense at least, Powell does represent some important strains in modern-day environmental thinking, namely that we ought to be taking a more long-term approach to thinking about how we should use resources?
Yeah, certainly. I think it's arguable that it's perhaps the most important strain in contemporary environmental thinking. I mean, it's certainly fair to say that it's the most influential strain. In fact, just recently, the second Earth Summit concluded in Johannesburg, South Africa, and the first one being the big meeting in Rio. And these meetings are meetings of many countries of the world organized around the theme of sustainable development. And sustainable development is, I think, at root a conservationist idea, the idea being that the natural world is there to be used for people, but that it ought to be used equitably and fairly. And so the concern is that we make sure that we make use of the natural world in such a way that both everybody in the current generation has an equal benefit from it, but also that people in future generations have an equal benefit. And of course, that means not depleting exhaustible resources. It means not exterminating species. It means not causing long-term climate change. And for the very kind of reasons that that Powell was advocating different land policies and sort of more cautionary approach to development in the West. So in a way, I think that conservationism has been embraced more easily in the world at large.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left here. I'd like to explore a couple themes if we have time to do so. And certainly one of them is just the point you made or the suggestion you just made that conservationism, a really rich form of conservationism, may not be all that different in practice than other forms of modern-day environmentalism or preservationism. Is that... Do you think there's at least something to that claim?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, I think this is a claim that has been become increasingly popular even in academic environmental philosophy, where perhaps the demands of practicality might be a little less overriding. People have been arguing that, in fact, we ought to get over this debate between preservationists and conservationists, that, in fact, both of them are working towards the same practical goals, and that, in some sense, the sort of ideological difference between them is, a distraction or shows unnecessary division within the forces of good.
Or at least it's a minor skirmish.
Yeah, I think that's right. My own view is that that while I certainly welcome the progress that's been made on the through the rubric of sustainable development and the kind of policies and agreements that have come out of the Earth Summit and the Kyoto Accords and so on, I still am a little reluctant to give up the ideological points so quickly. You can imagine, for instance, being an abolitionist in the first part of the 19th century, and hearing about a conference in the South where the idea of the conference was that people would speak about whether or not slavery was bad for whites in the South, whether it was economically disadvantageous. On the one hand, as an abolitionist, you might welcome that kind of conference, thinking that anything that contributes to the demise of slavery is a good thing. On the other hand, you might feel like, the underlying problem, the core mistake of slavery isn't being addressed. That is that blacks deserve their freedom, not just because it's a good idea for whites. And I can't help but feeling a little bit that way with respect to the Earth summits and to conservationism in general. So my own attitudes, I guess, are a bit ambivalent.
That practically it may be a wise strategy, but that the ideological point shouldn't be given up.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, eventually, there will be cases where the ideology does make a practical difference. People who think that the primary value, or perhaps the only value of the natural world, derives from its usefulness to humans, in some cases are going to make trade-offs that those of us who think that the natural world is valuable in its own right won't be prepared to make. We're going to count things as costs that people who see the value as derivative won't count as costs. So, while it's true that across a large swath of the practical issues that confront us, there can be practical agreement, I'm not convinced that there won't at some point be times when the ideological differences will matter.
Very quickly, we're almost out of time. For the listener, is this a book you would recommend that they read?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very readable story, as history books go, and for people who are interested in environmentalism and environmental history, I think it's really invaluable. For me, it really helped me to appreciate that the moral force behind conservationism of Powell's sort. You really get the sense that his concern is with people, and that's something to take very seriously. So, I think it's a good introduction to our environmental history, and one that's more than relevant even today.
Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've been speaking today with Christopher Knapp, professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.